The next matter on calendar is Hager versus State, case number 72613. Is counsel ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
And do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is John Petty, and good afternoon to members of the court, and may it please the court. My name is John Petty. I'm with the Washoe County Public Defender's Office, and I'm here this afternoon on behalf of Mr. Ian Hager. Mr. Hager was charged by the state with 6 counts of unlawful possession of firearms due to two prohibitions that are defined by statute. There was no contest that Mr. Hager was in possession of these firearms. They are his. In fact, he owned them. Just before these charges, they had actually been returned to him by law enforcement agencies in the state of Nevada. One being the city of Sparks, and the other being the Nevada Highway Patrol. The prohibitions that the state alleged are two, and I'm going to address them separately. So the first prohibition I want to talk to deals with counts 1, 2, and 3, and that is a prohibition that allegedly Mr. Hager had been previously adjudicated mentally ill and committed to a mental health court or a mental health facility. That statute and that subsection of the statute cannot apply in these facts. First, the statute does not create a prohibition based on admission to mental health court. And just momentarily, I heard my friend, Mr. McCarthy, tell the court that we should not be grafting elements onto a statute that the legislature did not intend. And if you were to conclude that mental health has some kind of, or mental health court has that application here, that's exactly what you would be doing. The statute, NRS 202-360, makes commitment to a mental health facility a prohibition. In Nevada, mental health facilities are defined by statute, NRS 433-233, as either Northern Nevada Adult Mental Health Services, or NAMHS, Southern Nevada Adult Mental Health Services, or SNAMHS, rural clinics, if they exist anymore, and Lakes Crossing. There was no evidence, none, presented before this jury that Mr.
But let me pause you for a moment. It seems to me that you're dropping the or out of the statute. You're equating adjudicated mentally ill with has been committed to any mental health facility, and I read those as two alternatives. So why isn't it the case that your client was adjudicated as mentally ill,
okay,
though not committed to a mental health facility?
Pardon me, Justice. I was going to get to the illness piece because I don't believe that's applicable here either. And I'll get to it as a singular piece in a minute, but just to address, I think, the predicate of your question, since you can read it as two, you can read the statute as saying adjudicated mentally ill or committed to a mental health
facility. That's what it says. It's not just permissive.
On March 1st of this year, Justice Pickering, in a dissent in a case called Dasani v. Kern and Associates, you pointed out that the word or is not always in the disjunctive. And in fact, you pointed out that a comma that precedes an or is often an indication that that or is, in fact, a disjunctive. In this case, the statute does not contain that comma. And in this case, because it does not contain that comma, if you will read this in the conjunctive, such that it is adjudicated mentally ill and committed to a mental health facility, you would basically be stating the predicate for an involuntary civil commitment proceeding under Chapter 433A, which is exactly what happens. A court adjudicates an individual mentally ill and commits that person to a mental health facility in Northern Nevada, NAMHS, which is a facility that's within the statutory ambit. So when I read this statute, I think it can logically be read as a conjunctive condition. But if you want to talk about it in separate pieces, I've already illustrated or explained why it can't be a commitment. So why can it not be an adjudication as mentally ill? And that is because if you look at NRS 176A255, all that it takes to get into a mental health report is a diagnosis, and in this case, PTSD was the appropriate diagnosis, and a court making the determination that it, quote, appeared that the individual seeking the placement, quote, appears to suffer from mental illness, end quote, and, quote, that he or she would benefit from assignment to a program established under NRS 176A250. The operative verbs in those, in that statute, 250, 255, and 260, the operative verbs are two. One is assign, the other is place. There is nowhere in those statutes where you will find the word commit or committed or commitment. The variation, the only other variation on one of those words in that statute is the word assign, where it converts the verb to the noun assignment. But there is no commitment, so there is no judicial act that's taking place. The person is merely, the court, I apologize, the district court is merely making the observation that this person appears to be mentally ill and would benefit from this program.
But why is that not an adjudication?
I believe it's not an adjudication. It is an assignment. It is a placement. It is putting somebody, the person has not even been convicted by plea. This person, in this case, Mr. Hager, has been diverted into the program. And adjudication does ultimately take place, and that is this. If the individual, such as Mr. Hager, successfully completes mental health court, then the court orders the case dismissed, the defendant discharged. That is an adjudicative act. That is a judicial act. It has a significant impact, too, because in addition to being discharged and the case dismissed, in the contemplation of the law, as the statute says, Mr. Hager is then returned to the status that he occupied prior to the filing, prior to his arrest and the filing of whatever the charging document was. That would be in 2013, 3 years before these charges came up. I think by virtue of the statutory language of 202.360, the 176A statutes, in combination or in harmony with the NRS 433A, that the circumstances that gave rise to Mr. Hager's involvement with these facts do not rise to a violation of that prohibition. And on that basis, I would ask that you reverse the first three counts.
Let me ask you this. If you read this as alternatives, either adjudicated as mentally ill or has been committed to any mental health facility, and focus on adjudicated as mentally ill, what other than assignment to mental health court would constitute a non-committed adjudication as mentally ill?
I see what you're saying.
It's an inarticulate question, but I'm trying to see what does that apply to if it doesn't apply to mental health court.
Well, I fear I may give you an inarticulate answer, but I'm going to try my best. It is, because I hadn't thought about it, but I think one can be adjudicated mentally ill, for example, if you have been found to be incompetent and committed to race crossing or return to competence.
But you've been committed.
In that situation, you have been committed because that's exactly what the statute requires. A court under NRS 178.425 makes a commitment to Lakes Crossing.
Right. But can you be adjudicated mentally ill and not committed to a mental health facility if we don't read the mental health court participation as an adjudication of mental illness?
Yeah, I see where you're going with that. I think that you have to read it together. But if you were to read adjudicated mentally ill as a standalone provision to keep you as being prohibited from possessing firearms, I would have to think through the statutes that exist out there that satisfy that condition. And maybe Nevada doesn't have any statutes that satisfy that condition, but this idea, this language, and this idea back in 2003 was lifted from existing federal statutes to bring us into compliance with some of their statutory schemes. I don't know, and I'll be honest with you, I don't know if that adjudicated mentally ill would be specific to or would address a standalone situation. So I really can't answer your question. But I would ask that that is, I would suggest that that is not fatal. Because whether you read the adjudicated and committed in the conjunctive, which makes it inapplicable, or you read it standalone adjudicated, the 176A statute for which this person was placed in the mental health care is not an adjudication of being mentally ill, so it doesn't apply anyway. That would be my answer.
Let me hold you up on the other part of your argument, the addict.
All right, then I'll try to do this briefly. The final three counts were the prohibition was based on whether or not the person was, Mr. Hager, an unlawful user of controlled substance or addicted to. The state actually argued that these were two competing theories to reach the same goal. The state, in its closing argument, said, listen, so many jurors could find that Mr. Hager is an addict. So many jurors could find that Mr. Hager is an unlawful user of controlled substances. You don't have to be unanimous in that finding, but you do have to be unanimous in the sense that there's got to be 12 of you who believe either one of those things together to get a conviction. Our statute doesn't define either of those terms. An addict is defined in a different section, but 202.360 doesn't define either term. And our suggestion is, following the invitation that I took from an earlier case by this court in Barrett's, that you ought to follow federal cases out of the Ninth Circuit and the Tenth Circuit that require that there, in order to be an unlawful user, that there be some regularity, that there be an extended period of time, and that it be contemporaneous with possession. And none of those categories exist here. There was no evidence to support regular use. Mr. Hager did not make statements of regular use. There were no witnesses that used with him or testified that they used with him. There were no controlled substances found in his house when it was searched pursuant to a search warrant, or his car when it was searched pursuant to a search warrant, or his person when he was arrested when his car was searched, which was a completely unexpected event. So it wasn't as though he could prepare for it. And with that, if I might reserve my time for the moment, unless you have been listening.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Thank you.
Mr. McCarthy.
Madam Justice, I'm still Terry McCarthy, Deputy DA from Washoe County on behalf of the state. And I can think of an adjudication that does not involve commitment to one of those facilities, and that is civil incompetence. When the court requires a guardian ad litem or appoints a guardian in general, it requires that sort of finding and doesn't involve commitment. Hope that helps. And I tend to see the statute as in the disjunctive. It would make no sense if that were just one sentence. It would make no sense to me anyway. Adjudicated mentally ill and committed. That would make sense. But is there a suggestion that you could be committed without being adjudicated? I'm not sure what that would be. So I think, because of the meaning of the various terms, it seems that it has to be or, not and. So, and I suggest that the adjudication is here. It's twofold. First, there's a judge in Winnemucca that sends this defendant to the mental health court in Washoe County. Then, in Washoe County, and by the way, it's not just a statute that requires that. There's actual evidence in the record that's cited in the briefs about how that happened, or that it did happen. And then, in Washoe County, in order to be accepted into the mental health court, there has to be a further finding by the mental health judge and based on a qualifying diagnosis. And so, you know, we got two different judges that are saying, yeah, this guy's mentally ill. I'm sure that's not the usual way. In fact, it's not usual at all. Nothing about this case is usual. But I suggest that because it's raised on the sufficiency of the evidence, that the evidence is in fact sufficient to allow the jury to conclude that this fellow had been adjudicated mentally ill twice, in fact.
Would it be different if he hadn't been found mentally ill and referred by Winnemucca to Washoe County?
If there had been no such...
You're making much of the fact that there were two adjudications of mental illness, the Winnemucca judge who then referred him to Washoe County.
No, I think it wouldn't make any difference. I find that interesting, but only because it's additional evidence. But if most of the people in Washoe County Mental Health Court are, in fact, from Washoe County, so right.
And so you're not making the argument that this case satisfies this statute, but a case that simply had a Washoe County defendant who was referred to Washoe County Mental Health Court and participated in that program, you're not saying that would be a different case?
Oh, goodness, no.
Okay.
No. Perhaps I put that down to hyperbole. You know, this is better because there's two judges. No.
Well, what do you say to Mr. Petty's point that this is not a formal adjudication, rather the only adjudication comes at the end if the defendant either successfully or does not successfully complete the period?
It is a finding coupled with an order. And that seems to meet the definition of adjudication. If the court, and then recently there was a decision that transmission of a record to the repository that deals with all this stuff doesn't have to await a final judgment. So I'd say that the fact right. that this is an interim finding coupled with an order is sufficient to be an adjudication. It's certainly not like a ruling in limine where it might be revisited tomorrow. You know, so pretty much the end of the Winnemucca judge's involvement, and then it's handed over to the mental health court at that point. So I don't know how it could not be an adjudication. We'd have to make up a new word for it, and I'm not sure what that word would be, but it's not adjudication. So anyway, based on the language actually used by the legislature, I suggest that this fellow is adjudicated mentally ill. Then the interesting part, though, is that being an addict or being a user of unlawful drugs, and you know, I'm not sure how that ought to be defined, the user part. I suspect it ought to be just, you leave it to the jury, because the proposal by the defense in this case wasn't any more definite. It was an extended period of time, for instance. I don't find that very helpful. So I think that the instructions given by the court were.
I think you're trying to capture the concept of habitual user,
And I think that might be implied by the instructions, but I don't think it's necessary to make that decision because the instruction offered by the defense, when this was viewed as an error in the instructions, that was even worse. The instruction actually given had a greater burden than did one offered by the defense. So I suggest that wouldn't be the error. And if the claim is really sufficient to the evidence, and excuse me, I have medication, my mouth is dry.
The instruction 16 was pretty tautological on what a user of a controlled substance is. It says a user of a controlled substance is a person who uses any controlled substance. Now that seems to me to be fairly unhelpful.
Could be better.
And so if you use it once, are you forever a user of a controlled substance? Is that... I can read that instruction to say that.
Well, I can't deny that it could be read that way, but when coupled with the arguments, I think that no reasonable jury is going to see it that way. And the argument here, I think, is more of sufficiency of the evidence than an error in the instructions.
Well, but they offered an instruction that was rejected. A person is an unlawful user of or addicted to if... A person who uses it has lost the power of self-control with reference to the use. is a current user, et cetera. They did try to do something more than the one-time use,
right,
making you a user.
I don't think that instruction was appropriate either. The one that the court gave, I mean, it could have been better, but what it ought to have been, some courts just say don't define it at all. Just leave it, let the jury decide what it means. I think most people would take that to mean a regular or habitual or long-term user, not just a casual user. Now, the evidence in this case would support the conclusion that this fellow has been a regular user for some time. The wealth of paraphernalia found in what he called his man cave, and a bunch of empty baggies and a meth pipe stuck in a drawer together, is coupled with the video of him ingesting that white crystalline substance and then admitting that it was methamphetamine and admitting that...
How far in the past was that evidence, though?
The video?
Yeah. Was there any evidence that he was currently a user in the present tense of narcotics?
That video is what inspired the investigation.
I understand that, but when did the...
How long did the investigation...
When was the video created is what I'm trying to find out.
Oh, I don't think it was long before the investigation. It was what led to the investigation because police were troubled by it because of the threats and such. And so that led to the investigation, the search, and the arrest. So I couldn't give you a date. I don't think it was very long.
No, I was just looking for whether there was a gap in time between the conduct depicted in the video and...
I think the dates of the alleged crime, the dates of the crime as alleged in the information would include the date of that video. I hate to be wrong on that, so I invite the court to fact check me on that.
Thank you.
So anyway, all that allowed the jury to conclude that he's both an addict and a user. And by the way, there's a response to a comment of mine in the answering brief suggesting that people can't be cured because there's lots and lots of recovering addicts. And I agree, there's lots and lots of recovering addicts. The pertinent word there is recovering, not recovered. But you don't really have to decide that. I just wanted to defend myself on that. So anyway, so I would suggest that he was adjudicated mentally ill. He's an addict, and he's a user of unlawful drugs, and he's in possession of weapons. And I would also suggest that the judgment ought to just generally be affirmed. I think it boils down to the question of the interpretation of the statute. And what does the word or mean, as we talked about earlier? I can think of... I suppose not guilty by reason of insanity would also be an adjudication in cases of dismissed, yeah, because the defendant is found to be incompetent and not likely to achieve competence. I suspect that would be an adjudication as well. And both of those would be, put one into that category of being a prohibited person. And this one too, so. Right. Once again,
Mr. McCarthy, could you address one additional argument? Instruction 16 included this phrase, a person commits the offense if his willfully possesses a firearm, not very well worded, while being addicted to or while an unlawful user of any controlled substance. The instruction seems to imply a mens rea requirement.
Right.
The statute, I think, establishes this as really a strict liability crime. But I want to get your thoughts on that. And if this, what's the effect of this use of willfulness on the harmless error?
I think that the willful, you can read this as a strict liability crime. This court has previously said when the state doesn't object to the inclusion of the word willful in the instructions, well, then that's the way it's going to be, even if it's supposed to be a strict liability crime. And we did not object to it. And frankly, I think it's appropriate because it's willful possession. So the act of possession is the part that must be willful. Usually, willfulness requires knowledge. Right? Excuse me. Possession requires knowledge. There's not a whole lot of difference here. But
so the point is, if willfulness had not been used, which is the principal argument that there's an incorrect nature in the instruction, had it been strict liability, it would have certainly resulted in a conviction.
Well, sir, you know, I think it is inappropriate to require any additional mens rea, because this jury was instructed on the theories of entrapment and estoppel that had to do with how he came to possess these guns. And this jury rejected it, so I think that the jury found that he wasn't tricked and that his possession was willful. So I agree that tends to make it largely academic. Okay, once again, I'm done. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
So let me begin by trying to set the time frame for you. So the video that really is the genesis of all of this was made in February 28th. That video was shared with the Detective Johnson around about March 31st, or the end of March. And it was a dramatization that was designed to capture the attention of the officer because Mr. Hager was frustrated that he thought they had botched the investigation into the death of his brother, and they were simply returning to him the notion, well, he died of methamphetamine overdose. And so he makes this video where he's forced to use a large amount of methamphetamine, shares with the deputy or the detective. In early April, that video, and I believe some other ones, were shared by Detective Johnson with the Sparks Police Department, and off to the races we go. The Sparks Police Department get search warrants for guns, not narcotics, go to the house, and here we are today. So the other thing I want to tie into that is this, is that you made the observation, which is rightly so, that instruction 16 defines an unlawful user as somebody who unlawfully uses. It is completely unhelpful. A one-time user could fall within the ambit of that language, and there's got to be something more about that language that cabins its enforcement than everybody's eligible. And if you look at this particular case and you look at the closing argument carefully, the prosecutor below was pinpointing that video, that supposed one-time use. Mr. Hager said he wasn't using methamphetamine. He did say to a police officer when he got arrested that it was methamphetamine, but at trial he said, no, it was kosher salt, that was what he said. But it was that February 28th video that the prosecutor honed in on to argue that he is an unlawful user. That is the same as to say, if you use it once, then you are an unlawful user. And by the way, ladies and the jury, you don't all have to agree on the theory, you can also agree on this other theory about being addicted to, because he had testified, and there was some other evidence, that said when he was 28 years old, he told the people in Winnemucca that when he was 12 to 19, he had been addicted to methamphetamine. That in 2013, he had used methamphetamine that January, and that in 2011, he had been addicted to OxyContin. After those dates, there is no evidence in the record. After that admission, there is no evidence in the record, with the exception, I think, of I think there may have been a use when he was in drug court or mental health court, but that had no effect. Otherwise, there was no use. The test for unlawful use in the Ninth Circuit, the Sixth Circuit, Fourth Circuit, a case that I had with me that says that every court that is...
You may finish.
Every court that has looked at this issue says there has to be some kind of pattern of use. It's not just a one-time use, and it's got to be contemporaneous with possession. And I would ask that you reverse all six counts because the evidence presented did not satisfy the statute. The colleague with the attorney was referring me to the punch because I, too, had planned to tell this court something that it already knows, and that is my friend, Mr. McCarthy, is retiring from the Washington County District Attorney's Office in June of this year, which means that this will be the last time that I have the pleasure of coming before this court in arguing the case with him. Every time that I've come down here and I've lost more than I've won, it has been a pleasure. I want to thank Mr. McCarthy for being the professional that he is.
Thank you, Mr. Petty. And on behalf of the court, I would like to thank Mr. McCarthy as well. Your advocacy is superb, and we have so much enjoyed associating with you over the years.
You've never found me out after all this time.
If I could add.
Yeah, Justice Hardesty would like to speak.
When I became a district court judge in 1999, Mr. McCarthy appeared a number of times in my department, as did Mr. Petty, my association with him goes back now more than almost 20 years, and even before that. Mr. McCarthy has been a real asset to the legal profession, an asset to the rule of law, and a contributor to this court's efforts. He may not have always agreed, as evidenced by a couple of arguments today, but I think that he has done much to help shape the criminal law in this state, and I think his efforts deserve great recognition and commendation.
Thank you for those very kind words.
One more,
Mr. McCarthy. Get all three of us through like that. Well, I get you. I've just observed again how collegial your argument is with Mr. Petty. I know you two have argued against each other many, many times here before us in the court, and certainly a pleasure to have both of you. And how well the Washoe County District Attorney's Office works together with the Public Defender's Office, at least in cordially presenting these arguments, maybe a lot better than our colleagues to the south here do. So, it's certainly a pleasure when you come in here, and I certainly wish you the best for the future. Maybe you'll take some pro bono cases or something. Nope.
I'm going inactive later on this year. I have a lot of time in Scottsdale, and I intend to go see the world. So.
Wow, great. So, it's going to be hot down there. You're going to miss Reno, though.
You're one of the advocates that you never have to double-check the record or the case sites or any of it, and you yield on points that are appropriately yielded on and stand for others, and I so deeply appreciate that. The intellectual honesty and familiarity with everything and the collegiality that my colleagues emphasize, but it's an example that really stands out, so go well. And if you're in Las Vegas, come see the Las Vegas Courthouse.
Thank you.